Good afternoon, you're listening to KFSK News for Wednesday, August 5th. I'm Taylor Heckert. A two-week-old humpback whale was found entangled in a gill net near Petersburg last week. A team of a dozen volunteers successfully freed the whale after 2 days of attempts. KFSK's Baze Hohen met up with the crew back on shore and has this story.
Heath Whitaker is at home chopping wood when he gets the call about the entangled whale.
We got a call that a whale was trapped in a fisherman's net, a gill netter's net.
Whitaker is a trained volunteer for Petersburg Marine Mammal Center, a local volunteer-run nonprofit which helps rescue and respond to distressed wildlife.
A lot of the members of the team work, you know, during the daytime, and so it took a little while for us to scramble out there.
He's told the whale is near Frederick Point on Mitkoff Island, towards the Stikeen River. The Stikeen River has a lot of glacial runoff into the Sound, so the water is really silty. When Whitaker reaches the whale by skiff, he sees that the young humpback is tied up in the gill net, which is still attached to the fisherman's boat. Soon after, Toby Bakus arrives. He's the stranding coordinator for Petersburg Marine Mammal Center. Whitaker's crew is just freeing the net from the boat, and Bakus and his crew try to get up to the side of the whale with a GoPro to get a better look at how badly the whale is tangled.
But it was so far down toward the Stikeen that water's especially murky, and we just didn't have any luck.
So after almost 8 hours out on the water, the crew has to retreat. Before they leave, Whitaker attaches a telemetry buoy to the net, a bright green buoy with a tracking device that beams back the whale's location to the team in real time. Then they call up the federal whale rescue expert.
So my name is Ed Lyman.
Lyman is the Large Whale Entanglement Response Coordinator for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. He's been rescuing whales for decades and works with communities in situations like these.
Free a whale if it gets entangled, when it does happen, prepare for it, do the trainings, and do the investigation, as in the science behind it, so we can help everyone.
Lyman is able to arrive in Petersburg the following day. He'd just been teaching a training session on whale entanglement in Tenakee Springs, a tiny town on nearby Chichagof Island. Based on what the Petersburg team reports, he has a pretty good idea of how the whale got entangled.
This youngster comes along, tried to punch through the net, and gets partway through and then panics and twirls.
Lyman says the net then wrapped around the whale's flukes, or tail fins.
And at this point, it's entangled. You know, it's enough of a wrap, it's entangled in the gear.
So when Lyman gets off the plane in Petersburg, a sort of Avengers team is assembled. The group of trained volunteers like Whitaker and Bakus, another group who offers their boats as support, Petersburg's Alaska State Trooper, who offers his boat as the main rescue boat, and Lyman. They hold a brief meeting, assign roles, load up with whale rescuing gear, then set off to find that green telemetry buoy. Whitaker, Bakus, and Lyman are on the main boat tasked with freeing the whale. Whitaker's role is to cut the net, and his cutting tool isn't fancy.
It's basically a long telescoping pole with sort of a homemade Spyderco knife.
Bakus stands right behind Whitaker on the boat, holding on to him.
Yeah, Heath had the pole, and I was just trying to keep him from falling off the bow.
Whitaker says it was hard to cut the line because the whale was not happy.
The whale was really moving away from us and being evasive, and so we kind of changed tactics and had to be a little more aggressive getting in on it.
Bakus says the whale kept diving below the surface. He said they made over 30 attempts to cut the line.
There were many misses. The tail would be too low. We couldn't even see the tail most of the time.
After 2 hours of following the whale in and out of the main channel in front of Petersburg, they get a hit.
And suddenly the line popped up to the water. The buoys stopped moving, and we saw the whale cruising off, and we were like, I think we got it. And yeah, it was pretty cool. Good feeling.
See, those are the two cuts.
After the mission is over, the crew gathers in Petersburg's harbor. They stand around the gillnet that trapped the whale, which is laid out on the dock. Lyman debriefs with the crew, pointing out where Whitaker made the cuts.
I mean, that's a cut.
Lyman says that it was great working with the Petersburg team.
So they have a long history here of working with the community, working with the fishermen, and boy, that's really refreshing. You need those key people, and Petersburg had a lot of those key people.
And for Whitaker, this was a big deal.
This was actually the first one that I got to cut, so I was pretty excited about that. That felt pretty good.
Then, as the sun begins to set behind the mountains surrounding the harbor, the crew loads up the gear into their cars and heads home. In Petersburg, I'm Baze Hohen.
Running water was restored yesterday in Heideberg, a small community of about 400 people on the southern end of Prince of Wales Island. The town was without running water for over a week. According to Heideberg Mayor Anthony Christensen, recent issues with the city's water pressure began in early July. In response, city workers bled the system to remove air locks in the line. Christensen says that only temporarily fixed the issue, and the city again had low water pressure within a few days.
So they had to go look further up the line and found that the line from the reservoir area where we draw from the river to the station where we chlorinate and filter our water, there was breaks, like three breaks in the line. So they had to go up and repair those three breaks and flush that and clean that and clear it out.
Christensen says workers followed the underground water line to stabilize pressure in the system. They're also replacing a section of piping. The town is under a water boil notice and is asking residents to conserve water when possible. Heideberg's burn ban notice, which was issued earlier this week when there wasn't any running water, is still in effect. This isn't the first time the city has experienced issues with its aging water infrastructure. Christensen says within the last year, it's experienced freeze-ups and breaks. The city is also waiting to build a dam and is currently pulling water with a pump from a nearby river. Christensen says that can complicate things.
You're pretty much subject to the ebb and flow of the river and, you know, how much rain comes and goes, and a higher siltation, so the pump's been struggling and keeping up with that as we wait to build a dam.
Numerous communities and organizations across southern southeast Alaska donated potable and bottled water in response to Heideberg's water crisis. Each household was supplied with potable water and a case of bottled water every day. Kluwak and Craig, an hour's drive from Heideberg, sent down their water operators to help resolve the issue. Groups in those towns also offered showers to those in need. A Canadian crew lost control of their sailboat about 1,000 miles southwest of Adak Island in June. They were rescued in an international Coast Guard effort, and the boat was left adrift. But the owner wasn't willing to abandon his sailboat, so he went back to find it. KUCB's Sophia Stewart Rossi reports.
It's a gray, wet day in Unalaska, and Luke Maloney is making tea in the cabin of his sailboat named the Mizuya.
The name Mizuya literally means water house in Japanese. But I practice tea ceremony and tea ceremony.
The Mizuya is a 40-foot trimaran that Maloney has been living in for the past year while sailing around East Asia. In early June, he and two crew members set out from Japan bound for Prince Rupert, British Columbia. 10 days into the voyage, the sailboat lost its rudder and they couldn't steer anymore.
And if you can't steer a boat, then you can't put the nose into the waves, you can't go anywhere. So I took the sails down, secured the boat, and then evaluated what to do.
Then a storm hit. The Mizuya was in 12-foot seas, and it was getting knocked around.
It was very uncomfortable, but I didn't know how long the boat could survive just bashing sideways to the waves. My sea anchor wasn't holding the nose into the waves. It was kind of a bit of an awkward situation.
Maloney made the call to get his crew off the boat. Relaying a message through another vessel's satellite phone, he reached the U.S. Coast Guard. The Canadian ship Sir Wilfrid Laurier was already in the region and sailed more than 575 miles to rescue them, which took about 40 hours. Maloney and his crew were handed off to the Japan Coast Guard and taken back to Japan. Everyone was safe, but the sailboat was left behind, adrift in international waters.
Well, when a boat is adrift in international waters, as I understand it, anybody who takes it, it's their boat. So I wanted to make sure that I got it first.
Maloney says his insurance doesn't cover salvage at sea, so if anyone else were to get the Mizuya, he'd have to buy it back. And he says he didn't have long before someone could take it. Maloney says the publicity around the rescue got people talking online about where the boat was and how to get it.
It's dangerous waters where this boat is. It's really remote, it's really cold. If some greenhorns go looking for it and don't find it, they could get into trouble.
Maloney flew from Japan to Unalaska as quickly as he could, and he hired the marine salvage company Resolve Marine to take him and his friend to the sailboat. Once they were near the general vicinity of the Mizuya, he said they searched 4 days in thick fog, trying to find where the sailboat had drifted. But they found it. After 2 weeks of leaving it behind, Maloney says the Mizuya was in good shape. Maloney says he and his friend fixed the mechanical failure in a few hours using replacement parts he'd bought and got the Musea sailing again. They traveled to Adak, waited for a break in the weather, and headed to Unalaska to begin the original voyage again.
It's almost the best case scenario. We found the boat. It wasn't seriously damaged. We were able to fix it. We were able to get it sailing. And we had favorable weather.
Back in the Musea cabin docked in Unalaska, Maloney is finishing up his tea.
Drink your tea. Have a cup of tea.
He recalls the whole experience as level 3 fun, the kind that's pure suffering in the moment, not much fun to look back on, but could be a wild story someday. In Unalaska, I'm Sophia Stewart Rossi.
Running around or playing pretend are big parts of summer as a kid, but some children need a more supportive environment to play their own way. Last week, KCAW's Lauren Salemo tagged along with an occupational therapist who tailors playtime for Sitka's neurodivergent youth.
9-year-old Avery rests a thin, foldable mat on his shoulders. Its two ends point straight ahead, like horns on a bull. He leans forward before charging across the Keet Gushihin Elementary School gym.
The fighter is scared. Bull's coming towards him.
Avery is part of the Neurodiverse Physical Activity Group. It's a collaboration between Sitka's Parks and Recreation Division and Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, that provides hour-long sessions of individualized play for kids on the autism spectrum.
Sometimes we challenge them and set up obstacle courses or try to do more of a structured game, but for the most part, this is their space to come and explore and play, and we're just here to facilitate it.
That's Whitney MacArthur, a physical therapist at SEARCH. She says organized sports aren't for everyone, so physical activity looks different for every kid.
The fun part about this group is really letting it be kid-led and see how they play and just adapt our play around them.
MacArthur plays right alongside the kids. She prances across balance beams, hops on trampolines, and acts out whatever character the kids dream up. She's been a bullfighter, a knight, or when another boy's here, a race car with a notable losing streak.
He is usually one step above me in upgrades, always, and I'm always slower than he is, and he usually has something he can throw at me.
Avery likes when there's a soundtrack to his imagination. As he and MacArthur build castles and fight monsters, video game music booms from a speaker in the gym.
Like Minecraft dungeons, custom Minecraft music, and a wither storm. Have you ever heard that thing?
But it's not all fun and games. MacArthur says it benefits the kids' gross motor skills too. Those are movements we make with our arms and legs, like climbing, throwing, or jumping.
It's a great opportunity for parents to meet each other too and build that support group as well.
Earl Pirtle is Avery's grandfather, who Avery calls Buddy. He says not every kid enjoys baseball, so letting Avery run around with this group is a good way to get his energy out.
For him, it's to get out of the house and do other things, other activities, and keep him more active rather than sitting in the house playing video games.
The group met every Monday and Thursday in July. Although this is the last session, Pirtle hopes there will be more in the future.
It's getting too close.
As the hour draws to a close, it's time to start cleaning up. MacArthur turns off the music, and Avery helps her put the mats and balls away. Once the gym floor is clear, Avery slips his sneakers on and runs toward the door.
Come on, buddy.
Wait.
In Sitka, I'm Lauren Salemo.
For Campus K, I'm Taylor Heckert.